This is the Breaking Bad Advice Podcast, the show that is dedicated to helping you stay rational in these irrational times. Here's where I remind you that the following thoughts and conversations are for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Please reach out to your financial professional at Plan Financial to discuss your unique situation and circumstances. All right, well, welcome everybody back to another episode of Breaking Bad Advice. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about the U.S. dollar, and is this the end of it, or is there more to come? We'll see. So Isaac, first of all, welcome back to the show. It's been a little bit, a lot of stuff has happened over this last month.
Yeah.
Including a lot of the headlines talking about the U.S. dollar, and is it getting ready to lose its reserve status as a global reserve currency? What are some of the headlines you've come across that you've found kind of fascinating?
Yeah, Joel, it's been a month or two, and before you know it, the dollar's on its way down. We're ready to write its tombstone, huh?
Oh yeah.
So yeah, I found a couple of headlines here. I thought I'd share. The first one is it says the decline and fall of the U.S. dollar. Right, that's from the Heritage Foundation. That was a little over a month ago. We have the U.S. is facing a major challenge as the petrodollar loses force. That's from Business Insider. The petrodollar, for people who don't know, is this idea that the reason the dollar has maintained its status as the reserve currency of choice is because of our relationship with Saudi Arabia and other OPEC countries, that we can basically make oil to be traded in dollars in the international markets. And so that's what people refer to as a petrodollar, because it's essentially tied to oil. So that's Business Insider declaring that, we're facing a major challenge. And then we had more recently the rise of the BRICS currency, shift away from dollar as default. And that was in Fortune. So, and for people who don't know, BRICS are a bunch of emerging market economies that continually make headlines talking about their goals and their desire to replace the dollar as the international currency. So the best one I found, though, the most concerning one, is the dollar fades as a reserve currency, and that was from Business Week as well.
So. Now, wait a minute. That last one you just gave, I have it here in my notes, that was from March 20th, but not March 20th of this year. That was March 20th of 1978.
That must be a typo. No,
yeah. So should the dollar not actually be a thing today, according to this, article? No, but in all seriousness, there's always been headlines throughout the years. I mean, yep. Clearly back to the 70s of the dollar is getting ready to lose its reserve status. Look out below. What's the status of the dollar today in your eyes? And actually not even in your eyes, but the world's eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is a recurring theme we've seen. Not just recently, obviously, not just, some people might say, oh, well, that was the 70s. Maybe there's a reason why. But really, we've seen this recurring theme at times in the 80s, the 90s, early 2000s. We've seen these sorts of headlines. So, yeah, that was kind of a joke. But really, what is the current status of the dollar? And we would say that, I think the dollar is going to be just fine for now. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I would say the major one is that the dollar continues to be right at the center of the global financial system. I'll give you one example. In December of last year, the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, which is a big international organization that kind of monitors central banks around the world and private banking activity, kind of on the level of like an IMF or the UN and these sorts of kind of multinational organizations, although this one doesn't necessarily have any sanctioning authority, but it does, it is viewed as sort of like a central bank to other central banks. So they have quite a bit of clout. And, they came out with a report in December that showed, and this is just one example, that the market for currency swaps and forwards, and these are complex derivative transactions that banks and hedge funds will enter into in the financial markets, they uncovered kind of not accidentally, I should say, but surprisingly, that there was almost $100 trillion in missing U.S. dollar debt in international financial institutions.
Meaning that debt is somewhere floating around out there?
Yeah, and they were unaware of its existence prior to last year, right?
I bet they were.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I mean, that kind of puts things in perspective a little bit, and that's not all traded in dollars, but they said the vast majority of it is, you know, roughly 85 to 90% of it. So, you know, you have, you know, 80 to $90 trillion of additional U.S. dollar debt in the financial markets around the world that they weren't even aware of prior to last year. And part of that is because of how banks and financial institutions run their quarterly reports, what they, you know, how they present their balance sheets. They have lots of ways of being very creative and hiding things. But, you know, I give that as just one example compared to what we often hear about in terms of what's going on here domestically. Right now, the domestic money supply, at least one popular measure, it shows that there are roughly $21 trillion of U.S. you know, dollars in what we refer to as M2 in the domestic marketplace. And so, you know, to put that in perspective, just one slice of the international financial system is, you know, roughly four times as large as what we might consider to be the U.S. dollar supply here.
Right. So, I mean, really, it sounds like there's a lot of dollar-denominated debt out there that people wouldn't just necessarily, I mean, I guess they could, but everybody would have to essentially default on each other in order to then move off of the U.S. dollar as a global reserve currency. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's one implication, and we can kind of get into a little bit more. But, yeah, essentially, once dollars are lent as the reserve currency, as the denomination of credit in international markets, you know, they are lent from one entity to another and not from, say, a U.S. government or U.S. business outside the U.S. These are international entities lending to each other. And so they not only want the dollars, there's demand obviously there for dollars. There's obviously a lot of supply. And what that implies is that both the supply and demand for dollars is much larger than we're aware of.
Right. And
it's much more dynamic. And so certainly, it's not a simple thing to say, well, the U.S. Or the international community no longer wants dollars because we're running massive deficits.
Right.
The reality is the marketplace for dollars in these what we would refer to as shadow banking systems are much larger than we're, you know, used to.
Right. So really the M2 number that you just mentioned, that really doesn't even scratch the surface on, you know, truly how many dollars are really out there outside of the U.S.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, even this massive number, yeah, that I just mentioned, right, 85 trillion roughly of U.S. dollar currency swaps and forward contracts. I mean, that's just a small slice of the pie. There's multiples of that out there in other forms of credit transactions. And so, you know, in short, there's really a lot of digital dollars out there. That's another component here to remember, is that a lot of these are done via a digital transaction. So there's not actually physical dollars being shipped via UPS planes or ships, you know, overseas.
Right.
These are balance sheet transfers from one bank or one hedge fund to another. And so it's created very seamlessly. But it also means that in order to pay back this debt, all these entities and governments around the world need dollars.
Right.
And so one of the implications of that, or one of the things that we see, is that over the last 10, 15 years, rather than the dollar continuing to weaken, we actually have seen it strengthen. And so one common measure of the value of the dollar is there's really two different indexes that are used, but one of them, the one we prefer, is the trade-weighted index. And it's basically comparing the value of the dollar to all of our trade partners around the world. And what we've seen is, you know, over the last 17 years or so, it's appreciated about 20% compared to all these other currencies.
Yeah.
That's not a sign of a weakening currency or one that's fading, right?
Right. So, and actually, I mean, to give another real world example is, if you take a look at Argentina, it's a country that, you know, has consistent consumer price inflation of over 100%, you know, annually. What is it now? 140% or something like that. It's something ridiculous.
Yeah. Makes our 9% feel kind of
cheap. Yeah, cheap, right. Yeah. But really looking, I read an article the other day, and there's almost a black market for U.S. dollars. As soon as they're receiving, is it the peso, mm-hmm. the Argentine peso, they're trying to turn it around real quick and get dollars as quick as they can just for the store of value aspect.
That's right. Yeah, that is a good real world example. And I actually ran across a headline in Bloomberg just the other day that said, I think the title was "The Hottest Jobs in Argentina Are the Ones That Pay in Dollars."
Yeah.
So again, you know, not an indication of a currency that's falling out of favor with the international community. In fact, right. It seems to be that the international communities are increasing their demand for dollars.
Right. Yeah. They even have a guy, I guess it's their, what is equivalent to be their president, running for office based on, hey, we're going to turn this whole economy here in Argentina and being based on the U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
Now, whether that actually ends up happening or the guy dies before he, you know, gets elected
right.
Is a different story. But right. Truly, there is a large, large need for the dollar.
Absolutely. Yep.
So moving on then, how does the U.S. dollar tie in with interest rates, the direction they head, and you know, why may some people may say, well, rates could go up based on, you know, demand for the dollar?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to understand that there is, obviously there are multiple aspects to these relationships: the demand for the dollar, supply for the dollar, interest rates on sovereign debt bonds, which is U.S. Treasuries. All of these things are related and they're interconnected, but there's no simple causal relationship between one or the other. And I think a lot of times we hear narratives in the news that say, they purport to explain the move in one asset based on one other factor.
Right. Like you see China beginning to get rid of or dump U.S. treasuries. That means interest rates are going to rise.
Correct. Yeah. Or it means that China doesn't want dollars anymore.
Right.
And the reality is there's so many other variables going on that I think we need to maybe take a step back and look at how the international monetary system can help us understand some of these isolated phenomenon that we see. And so one of the things that's been catching a lot of airtime lately, especially with all these headlines coming out about the dollar fading into oblivion, is that as you just mentioned, a lot of these international corporations, but also specifically official treasury holdings for places like China and Japan, their central banks in particular have been selling treasuries, right? So we're seeing Since the peak for international holdings was somewhere in late 2021. So over the last year and a half or so, we've seen a decline in some of the largest international holders of treasuries. They've actually been selling their treasury bonds. And so some people are going, well, this is the beginning of the end, right?
Right. They're moving on from the dollar. They're going to start doing their transactions in yuan or whatever it may be.
Yep. And you know, I mean, I think again on a superficial level that that makes sense, right? But then what we would expect to see if that were true is we would likely see demand for dollars also declining, right? So if people are selling U.S. treasuries because they don't want to hold dollars, they don't want to use dollars anymore, and so they're getting rid of them to buy presumably their own currency or gold or Bitcoin, probably not, but you know.
This isn't 2021 anymore.
That's right. So, you know, presumably that's what they would be doing. And yet what we found, and I mentioned it earlier, is we've actually found demand for dollars continuing to rise. And so last year, even though we were suffering from a pretty high inflation rate, and even though some of these central banks around the world were selling U.S. treasuries, what we actually saw was that the dollar was appreciating against all of the other currencies. In fact, it appreciated against pretty much every other currency in the world last year by a pretty considerable margin. And this, you know, it tends to confuse people, I think, because they fail to realize that often these foreign countries and businesses sell treasuries because they need U.S. dollars,
right?
Not because they're trying to get away from U.S.
right.
dollars, right?
Right.
And again, that goes back to this international financial system that I referred to, where there are so many credit transactions done in dollars. Those credit transactions eventually have to be repaid in dollars. And so when credit tends to dry up, when economic growth slows down, obviously the demand for dollars goes up, right?
Right.
And actually, at the same time, the supply tends to go down. Right.
Right.
So when the economy is struggling, creditors are less likely to extend or renew credit, and so you see the supply go down, at the same time, demand tends to go up.
Right.
So, one example of this, or one example that's kind of related to this that we've seen over the last several years is, as I mentioned, China is one of the largest holders of U.S. Treasury debt. They were the largest for several years. Between them and Japan, they hold quite a bit of it. But their holdings of U.S. Treasuries have actually gone down from, it looks like, about $1.3 trillion in 2015 was kind of the high point. And it's dwindled all the way down to about $850 billion earlier this year. And so, again, that kind of reinforces to some that, well, maybe China doesn't want our treasury debt anymore. They don't want to finance our irresponsibility.
Right. Well, and they are part of BRICS. So I guess that would be a pretty bad look if they just continue to support the U.S. dollar, right?
Right. Exactly. So it all kind of fits together, and yet, it's interesting because at the same time they've been selling treasuries and supposedly not wanting to deal in dollars, the currency that they use, the Chinese yuan or the renminbi, whatever you want to call it, has actually weakened against the dollar by about 20%.
Right.
Which again is not an observation that doesn't make sense if the narrative that we just explained is true. So what is it? Well, there's really two possible interpretations, right? One is that China is selling because they don't want the dollar, and thus that would, we would think, produce a weaker dollar, which is not happening. Or China is selling treasuries to obtain dollars that their financial system needs in order to prop up their own currency.
Sure.
Because they're trying to maintain the value of the yuan compared to the dollar. And so what we've seen is typically the amount of treasuries they hold will dwindle or go down when the yuan is struggling against the dollar.
Right. Right.
And so it just tends to reinforce when you kind of look at a lot of different angles, it tends to reinforce that actually the demand for dollars is very, very, heavy at this point.
Yeah.
And so some of these narratives just don't add up to what we're actually seeing.
Right. Right. So speaking of narratives, let's look at another narrative for rates to remain elevated. And that is that inflation is here to stay or it is stickier. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously we talked about it, I think, in our last podcast that, CPI, the official inflation rate, has declined just over 9% in June of last year down to slightly north of 3% last month. So it's come down, close to 6%, over 6% in about 12 months. That's a pretty significant decline.
Right.
But some people think, well, this is the low point, and we're off to the races from here. And yet what's interesting is, I make this point as kind of a statistical, notion, is that the reason inflation is still even at 3%, one could argue is mainly simply because of the way, the U.S. government calculates the statistic. The reality is that the vast majority of the 3% inflation that we currently have, the official 3%, is really it's a relic of the hot real estate market we had in 2021, 2022. The way they input prices from the real estate market into the CPI is really at a lag of 12 to 24 months. But what we've seen over the last, say, 10 to 12 months is that real estate prices have essentially stagnated. In fact, they're negative year over year at this point.
Yeah, I was gonna say we begin to see them actually turn over.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so the irony is for the last 12 months, if you look at actual real estate data, prices are flat or negative. And yet in the CPI, almost all of that 3% that we're seeing is attributable to a housing component that is no longer relevant.
Right.
And so we would expect, unless something changes, unless we have an increase in something, prices somewhere else over the next 6 to 12 months, we would expect this 3% number to likely go down from here as well.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And so, I mean, with that being said, does that mean that we could have a reignition in inflation? Let me preface this with consumer price inflation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the fear, right? In fact, didn't you you had some graph you wanted?
I came across this really nifty chart on Twitter that, because Twitter has all the factual data,
all the real stuff. Yeah,
and it's basically showing from 1972 to 1976, there was a period of where inflation went from roughly 2 to 3% up to 8-9%. Then it started to come back down to the 3-4% range. Sound pretty familiar so far? I mean, that's exactly so far what has happened from, you know, 2020 and on.
That's right.
However, back in the 70s, it ended up spiking back up to near 14%. Now, it came back down after that, but a lot of people are arguing, well, look what happened back then. It's going to happen again today. It's spiking from here. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously nobody knows the future, right? And so is it possible that we could have a massive price spike again, like we had last year, the year before, like we had in the late 70s? Of course, it's possible, because if we got into a war with China and or oil went back to $250 a barrel, which some people think it will do, obviously that would have reverberating effects throughout the economy and it would increase prices. So it is possible, but why do we think it's unlikely? One of the things that we've talked about in the past several times is the yield curve. Okay. And the importance of the yield curve comes in when you realize that who are the primary dealers in treasury bonds, right? We've talked about the yield curve. The yield curve is this idea that different maturities in treasury debt have different interest rates. And so typically the longer dated treasury debt tends to have a higher interest rate. And so under normal economic conditions, you would expect what we refer to as an upward yielding, upward sloping yield curve, right? And so if you were to loan the government money for 30 years, you'd get a higher interest rate than if you loan them money for 30 days, right? That's your typical yield curve. And the people who primarily deal in treasury bonds are banks, international central banks, hedge funds, what we refer to as non-bank financial intermediaries. And so there's all these financial companies out there that are extending credit or contracting credit at any time. And they're the ones that are primarily buying and selling treasuries all the time. So when we all of a sudden run into an economy where there's concerns about growth, there's concerns about contraction and economic activity, what tends to happen is a lot of these institutions will start buying longer dated treasuries. And what that does is it actually drives the price up, drives the yields down, the interest down, and you end up with what's called an inverted yield curve, right? And so as we've talked about in the past, inverted yield curves have preceded pretty much every recession for the last, 40, 50 years at least, if not well beyond that. And ordinarily, yield curves tend to invert prior to slower inflation, slower growth, or lower inflation and lower growth, if not severe economic crises.
Right.
And so it's interesting when we compare the 1970s to today, the question would be, okay, well, what was the yield curve telling us back then? And what is it telling us today? Well, when we look at the yield curve at that lull in the 1970s, that graph you were referring
to, 1972 to 1976.
Yeah. Yeah. What was it telling us during that period? Well, in 76 into 77, it was upward sloping. It was what you would consider as maybe not a healthy economy, but it was certainly a yield curve that was saying, hey, we expect higher interest rates.
Right.
We expect higher inflation.
Right. And an economy that's going to continue to grow due to many different factors we don't have to get into, but it's up from here.
It's up. And sure enough, the yield curve was correct. As we saw in the 1970s, and inflation went back up. Well, what is it telling us today? Well, today it could not be further from the truth, but further from what it was telling us
back in the 70s.
That's right. It could not be more opposite, right? It's heavily inverted. In fact, it's the inversions at some points are historical records at this point. So, and what does that tell us? Well, it tells us that the main actors in the bond market, those who actually create dollars in the international financial markets, they are pulling back. They are concerned. And they're willing to buy safe and liquid assets, even if it means they have to take a lower interest payment on a, say, a 10-year treasury bond than they could get in a 30-day treasury bill.
Right.
And that, again, is a telltale sign of lower growth, lower inflation. Secondly, the reality is that the inflation spike we had in 2020, 2021 into 2022 really was the factors, as we've talked about in past podcasts, is the increase in the money supply that the U.S. government did by sending checks directly to Americans, and the shutting down of the economy, created what we refer to as a supply shock. That's where a big chunk of that price spike came from.
Right. So nothing changed fundamentally. It was just kind of a short term, hey, we're closing down the economy. Here's all this money. So now you have more dollars chasing fewer goods.
Right.
A recipe for consumer price inflation.
Yeah. And we would make a distinction that the increased dollars did have a permanent inflationary aspect to it. But the shutting down of the economy and we would argue the Russia-Ukraine war last year were one-off events that would create supply mismatches and increase the prices.
And we only saw consumer price inflation get to 9%. That's it after all that?
Depends on who you ask. But yeah, it was it spiked. But yeah, right? I mean, compared to the 70s, at least if we assume the metrics are essentially the same, obviously we didn't see it quite as bad last year.
Right.
It's come down. And the real question is, so outside of something like that happening again, something like a global pandemic where they shut everything down, or something like a war, another war that could cause oil to go to $250 a barrel, right? Outside of something like that happening again, we just don't see the same factors there. Yes, there is an increase in the money supply that's pretty much consistent. And we would say that that is inflationary over time in the sense that it will always lead to higher prices than would have existed otherwise. And that is because the U.S. government runs a deficit every year in the range of $2 to $3 trillion, which sounds like a lot because it is a lot of money.
Right.
But as we've been talking about this entire time, what people don't always realize is that as much as that $2 to $3 trillion sounds like a gigantic number, the reality is that the global dollar marketplace is much, much larger.
Right. Right. And really to kind of put a bow on this podcast, you have a good analogy for our listeners to kind of think about this as, and what is that?
Yeah. I mean, I think if the government's printing $2 to $3 trillion, okay, let's imagine for a second that
this is every year
at this point,
or is it every day?
Does it even matter? yes, it is. It roughly at this point, they're in the range of between $2 to $3 trillion of a deficit, right? And so they have to run, in order to run that deficit, they have to finance it by issuing treasury bonds, which the Federal Reserve then purchases indirectly. And so that's how we end up with additional dollars in the system. But that's one way anyways. But what I like to give an analogy of is, suppose for a second that the U.S. government is doing this and we could fit $2 to $3 trillion in a glass of water, right? We'll just assume that the $2 to $3 trillion is a glass of water. You know, if you were to pour that into a medium-sized salad bowl, you would definitely be able to see the water level rise, right?
Sure.
Obviously, it would be small enough that where you could very feasibly see a visible, obvious difference in the water level in the bowl. But what if you poured that cup into a swimming pool? Would you be able to see it once it got into the water? Most people would say no, it just disappears into a much larger body of water. And I think that's what we need to understand, is that the euro dollar system, this international system for dollars, is so much larger, so much more vast, and so much more complex than our domestic dollar system, that as much as we are adding to the dollar supplies here, the effects of dollar supply and demand in the international markets dwarfs what we're doing here. And so that's why we just don't expect these deficits to matter much, at least not yet.
Not yet. And I think that is the key moving forward. At some point, there's going to come a day of reckoning. The question is, when will that be? And will they just continue to kick the can down the road?
Yeah. And I think, in hindsight, as we look kind of over our entire conversation here, I think there will be things we can look at in the international markets that will tell us, hey, demand for dollars is changing.
Right.
People are using a different form of currency to backstop their credit transactions.
Right. Things are changing fundamentally, not, hey, Bitcoin's going to take over. And it's like, no, well, you don't understand that when people are buying things in Bitcoin, they're actually using dollars still. So until people are to across the nation only transact in Bitcoin and not end up converting it back to dollars or any, name any other currency.
Right.
There's still no structural change.
Exactly. And as long as we see the U.S. dollar strengthening against all the other currencies in the world, which has been a pretty much a consistent thing over the last 15 years. We have no reason to think that that anything is going to change in the financial system, and therefore we would expect that the dollar is going to retain its dominance.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well, hey, Isaac, I appreciate your time today. And as always, I look forward to our next conversation.
And that does it for another episode of Breaking Bad Advice. As always, you can find this episode along with the latest newsletters and blogs on planfinancial.com. Until next time, stay safe, stay rational.